The next case on our calendar is 04-141, John Morgan versus Daniel Eads. Mr. Cole.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Douglas Cole on behalf of Attorney General Jim Petro. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I'd also, before we get going, like to apologize for my voice. I'm recovering from a cold, and I feel better than I sound, luckily, but I apologize.
You may want to lean into the microphone there a little bit.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case asks the court to answer two vitally important questions regarding the role that Ohio Rule of Appellate Procedure 26B plays in the Ohio judicial system. Questions at the federal court said, I quote, cry out for an answer from the Supreme Court of Ohio. In particular, the federal court has asked this court to definitively determine whether Rule 26B proceedings are part of post-conviction or instead are part of direct review. At some level, it's surprising that the federal court even needed to ask, as three factors unequivocally demonstrate that it is post-conviction. First, this court has always referred to such proceedings both in its rules and in its opinions as, quote, civil post-conviction matters. Second, Ohio's lower courts have uniformly treated them accordingly. And third, an examination of the way in which Rule 26B operates demonstrates that the courts were correct to do so. The reason the question was necessary, though, is that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in White versus Schotten improperly ruled that as a matter of Ohio law, Rule 26B proceedings are part of direct review. This improper ruling has had dramatic consequences for Ohio convictions in habeas review, and this case is the opportunity for this court to correct this question of Ohio law and definitively state that Rule 26B is part of post-conviction. Rule 26B proceeds, as this court knows, in two phases. First, the application phase, where the prisoner, where the defendant must demonstrate a genuine issue as to whether the applicant was deprived of the effective assistance of counsel on appeal. If that application is granted, then it moves on to the new appeal stage. The defendant is appointed a new counsel, and there's a new proceeding where the defendant is allowed to raise issues that weren't raised in his first appeal. The court, the federal court, has asked a question about each stage, whether at the application stage or at the reopened appeal stage, whether it's part of direct or part of post-conviction. At both stages, the similarity to post-conviction review, other forms of post-conviction review in Ohio, is overwhelming. First, the rule envisions the possibility of new evidence. In fact, there's a specific provision in the rule, 26B8, that says there can be a new hearing. The magistrate can be appointed. New evidence can be taken. Second, the 26B case can proceed while the direct appeal is still ongoing. That is, if there's a conviction and then an appeal to the intermediate courts of appeals and then an appeal to this court, the 26B proceeding can continue to occur in the appellate court while the direct review itself is going on in this court. Certainly, there can't be a direct review pending in two separate courts at the same time. It makes perfect sense, of course, if Rule 26B is part of post-conviction.
Mr. Cole, can I ask you a question about this? It wasn't raised as an issue, but I'm just curious. I wasn't real clear exactly what the document is here. Apparently, it's backup material for an audit that a federal agency did of the Summit County agency. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The documents that are... I
think that's the next case, Your Honor. Is that Gilbert?
No.
That's the public records case?
Yeah,
you're right. I'm sorry.
That's right, Your Honor.
Yeah, right.
It's not at all surprising that there's a similarity to other forms of post-conviction with respect to Rule 26B when we consider that Rule 26B was specifically designed to act as an appellate court analog to post-conviction review in the trial court under 2953.21. That is, Rule 26B was adopted in response to this court's decision in Murnahan, where this court held that post-conviction proceedings in a trial court under 2953.21 would not be an appropriate spot in which to raise ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. So the Rules Advisory Committee said, well, we'll come up with a different spot, a more appropriate spot, an appellate court vehicle for raising these essentially post-conviction types of claims. And Rule 26B was the result.
Are we somehow compounding the problem here? This is really not But by using terms, post-conviction or direct appeal, the Sixth Circuit seems to be saying that it has to be one or the other. But it really, this is really more like a post-appeal, is it not, our rule? Doesn't our rule, it looks like, I mean, if you, Murnaghan is obviously challenging the competency or the effectiveness of counsel at the appellate stage. Should we not be trying to fit this process into post-conviction, which is traditionally a trial level challenge, or direct appeal? It can be something else, can it not?
Well, Your Honor, I'd suggest that for purposes of the question that was certified to the court, it matters greatly under federal law whether something is part of direct or part of post-conviction, or at the very least, it's important that it be made clear that it's not part of direct, whatever else it might be, whether post-conviction or not. And the reason it matters is because the habeas statute says that the statute of limitations for a habeas petition in federal court begins. It's a one-year period that begins when, quote, direct review is terminated in the state court. So if this is part of direct, that would trigger the statute of limitations, 1 year, whenever the 26B is ruled on.
I guess if we decide it is not direct, we don't have to say it's post-conviction, do we? It doesn't have to fit into that post-conviction statute, because obviously Murnaghan is different. It's not post-conviction. Post-conviction, the statute goes to challenging the effectiveness of counsel at the trial level, and we've created this sort of special right for counsel parties to challenge the effectiveness of counsel at the appellate level. So does it really matter? For purposes of the federal rule, does it matter what we call it if we don't call it direct appeal?
Well, at the end of the day, Your Honor, I believe the federal court is going to have to say it's either direct or post-conviction, one of the two, because there's only two types of...
That's the only language they understand.
That's the only thing they understand. If it's direct, it triggers the statute of limitations. If it's post-conviction, it tolls the statute of limitations. It's one or the other. Similarly, with respect to right to counsel, the court's going to say it's either part of the initial appeal. A federal court will say it's either part of the initial appeal of right or it's not part of the initial appeal of right. If it's part of the initial appeal of right, or as the court in White used a little looser language, if it's part of the direct appeal, then it's going to trigger a right to counsel. So if the court is at least specific in saying it's not part of the direct appeal, that counsel issue should go away, but there's still going to be the separate issue of how does it interact with the statute of limitations under AEDPA for federal habeas purposes. But clearly it's not part of the initial appeal of right, the first appeal. This is not even of right, of course. You have to file an application, which can be granted or denied in the discretion of the court, depending on whether or not you've created a genuine issue with respect to effectiveness of counsel. So even if it's somehow, you know, it can't be clearly characterized as direct or post-conviction, it should be clear, and I hope the court would clearly articulate, that it's not part of the initial appeal of right that someone receives from a conviction in Ohio. It's a very different vehicle than that. And I guess in further response to your question, Chief Justice Moyer, I'd say that the fact that it doesn't seem to fit within the language of the post-conviction statute, I don't think there's any reason that post-conviction as a label has to mean merely those things that fit within the trial court post-conviction statute in Ohio. The question of whether or not it falls within post-conviction could be this broader question of, assuming things are direct or post-conviction, which does it fall in?
Well, if post-conviction is a generic term rather than a statutory term, it's used in the statute as post-conviction relief, and so if it's generic, then your argument makes sense.
Sure, and it's not, I don't think it's generic. There's actually, I think, three different senses of it. There's post-conviction, I guess, could have a constitutional, be a label of constitutional import when we're dealing with right to counsel, because it matters if it's post-conviction, you don't have a right to counsel, and we can go back and look at the case like Pennsylvania versus Finley. Post-conviction has a federal statutory meaning because it's part of the AEDPA statute that says that while a post-conviction action is pending, your statute of limitations is tolled. And post-conviction also has a meaning under Ohio statute, which is these proceedings under 2953-21 in the trial court. But if we're talking about where does Rule 26B fit generally, I don't think we have to say, under the Ohio statute, statutory definition of post-conviction, does it fit under that? We're talking now about some more generalized sense of what we mean by post-conviction relief. And there, if we look at the way in which 26B operates, and in particular the fact that we can have new evidence and a new decision based on that new evidence, it just looks very much like what we traditionally think of as post-conviction generally. That is a new proceeding that challenges what happened in a proceeding before. Unless the court has further questions, I think at this point I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Carroll.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Jadine Carroll. I am counsel for the respondent, Daniel Eads. Your Honor, is the answer to the question posed, two questions posed to this court by the district court are, yes, appellate rule 26B applications are part of direct appeal, and yes, they become part of direct appeal at the point when they are filed. Before turning to my argument, I'd like to address two points, one made by the Chief Justice and one made by Mr. Cole. Your Honor, Mr. Cole says that appellate rule 26B motions are separate and apart from the direct appeal. And he cites this court's rule 2D. That rule doesn't stand for that proposition at all. What that rule says is that when there is a discretionary appeal from the Court of Appeals to this court, the Court of Appeals can only do one of several things. Act in aid of the judgment, that is, not disturb the judgment. Two, consider a motion to certify a conflict. And three, consider an application for reopening under Appellate Rule 26B. All three of those deal with the appeal pending before this court on discretionary review. The motion to certify a conflict raises no new issue in terms of the issues presently pending before the court on a memorandum in support of jurisdiction. It simply is asking the Court of Appeals to identify the fact that there's a conflict. So it's the same issues or issue that is before the court of the Supreme Court on the memo in support. And second, the appellate rule 26B doesn't raise an additional direct appeal. It focuses this court's attention, hopefully, on the fact that the original direct appeal was defective because counsel was ineffective. So it calls upon the Court of Appeals to identify issues that should be attached to the direct appeal.
Counsel, in a post-conviction relief in the trial court, you can raise ineffective assistance of counsel on a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You can also attack it by way of a post-conviction relief motion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In a appeal from the appellate decision to this court, can you attack ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal?
On a discretionary appeal from the Court of Appeals to this court?
Yes.
I presume one could. I would doubt that if it were the same appellate counsel at both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, that would happen.
Well, you have that same problem at the trial level
Correct.
To the Court of Appeals. So you can do the same process. And you can also
Yes.
attack the Court of Appeals ineffective assistance of counsel by a 26B, correct?
You could. Yes, Your Honor.
So to me, those are parallels that suggest to me that is a post-conviction relief type of motion, because you have in both cases a direct appeal avenue and you have a collateral attack avenue. And so I guess I'm having trouble understanding why one is a post-conviction relief and the other has to be part of the original appeal when you have the ability in an original appeal to this court to attack ineffective assistance.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel.
That also relates to the Chief Justice's question, and that is, does it matter what we call it? It does matter what you call it. If it's post-conviction, and Congress chose those words precisely, if it's post-conviction, no right to counsel attaches, as no right to counsel attaches on discretionary review. And when we look at post-conviction, what we see are very distinctive differences between post-conviction and an appellate motion,
But in post-conviction, you can have some very serious and real ineffective assistance of counsel issues, and you
Yes.
have no right to counsel there.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why is that any less important or more important than, you know, insisting you have counsel at the appellate level for a 26B when you don't give it to them at the post-conviction? I mean, they're both attacking the whole foundation of the verdict.
I agree, Your Honor. The major distinction would be drawn from this court's decisions in State versus Perry and State versus Cole. In State versus Perry, at syllabus paragraph 9, this court defined a limitation for post-conviction relief. Syllabus 9 says that issues that could have been raised or were raised at trial or on appeal may not be raised in PCR. We also know in State versus Cole, a 1980 so decision from this court, that if the issue of a trial and effectiveness appears on the record, new counsel must raise it. So what we know from those two cases is that if there are issues of trial counsel ineffectiveness on the record, they must be raised on appeal. What does that leave? What that leaves is post-conviction relief, 2953.21, the post-conviction relief statute born out of Case versus Nebraska. What that leaves is issues that do not appear in the record. Our position would be that the defendant would likely know what he had asked or she had asked her, his or her counsel to do, that counsel did either improperly or did not do at all. So those would be peculiar matters known to the defendant. Because there is a close relationship between trial counsel and the defendant, the trial counsel would be apprised that the defendant wished to have witnesses subpoenaed.
So he would know. That implies a level of intelligence among counsel that sometimes trial judges even fail to grasp. I mean, you're assuming that they can figure out what their counsel did wrong when we struggle with those issues constantly on appeal.
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is the defendant would know what he had asked his counsel to do, subpoena witnesses, and that they didn't show up at trial. He would know that. And the distinction between knowing what you had asked your trial counsel to do and knowing what appellate counsel failed to do is the key. The defendant at trial knows what he's asking his attorney to do. The appellant on appeal has no idea, in most cases, what the record reflects. That person may have been in that trial for a week, a month, or longer, and is the subject, of course, of the prosecution. That person would not have any objectivity and would certainly not know what issues had been objected to, what issues had been preserved years after the event.
Do you do trial work or just appellate work?
Both, Your Honor.
Do you usually have your clients telling you what to do at a trial?
Unfortunately, yes, Your Honor.
Do you follow their advice?
I don't always follow their advice, Your Honor, but I think it's very important to have the client sitting next to you participating for a variety of reasons. One is that person was there at the event and I wasn't in most cases.
Okay.
But the point I'm making, Your Honor, is there's a distinction, and that is if you're the trial defendant, you know what you told your attorney. If we turn now to appeal, the defendant, who doesn't have benefit of the record, has no idea of what was preserved years, months after the trial. And our position would be, in a sense, akin to Justice Pfeiffer's concurring opinion in State versus Gum. This court decided that State versus Gum September 22nd, last week. The court, I would say, loosely and probably not favorably to my case, said that the defendant in that case had counsel, had continuing counsel, was aware that he could file an application, and 9 years after the fact, his failure to do so amounted to no good cause. But in your concurring opinion, Justice Pfeiffer, you said that perhaps the better way to look at the beginning of that running of that time was either when appellate counsel dropped off or the defendant obtained new counsel. We would suggest to the court that maybe an expansion of that rule would be this. That if you're going to hold an appellant to filing an application for reopening, to raise complex legal issues of appellate ineffectiveness, you have to either give that person an attorney or you have to give that person access to the record. When either of those occur, then the 90-day period for filing the application for reopening would apply. And it makes sense that it would apply then, because how else would a potentially semi-literate defendant have any clue of what was raised on appeal, what was raised, and how that relates to what should have been raised under Appellate Rule 26B, or what was raised inappropriately on an incomplete record? So what we would say is that unless the record reflects that either of those things occurred, the appellant should not be held strictly to that 90-day period. And how could that happen? That could happen very simply. If there is new counsel simply files a notice of appearance, we know there's new counsel. That begins the running of the 90-day period. If counsel is done with the case on direct appeal, counsel could simply send a copy of the transcript to the appellant and notify the Court of Appeals via a letter, and that would again trigger the 90-day period. But without those recourses, that is, write to counsel or the record, it's virtually impossible for an uneducated defendant to determine at all what issues under Appellate Rule 26B should have been raised that weren't or were raised on an incomplete record.
Counsel, would you equate the appointment of appellate counsel and the submission or the delivery of the record to the defendant as being equal alternatives here?
No, I think it's inferior, Your Honor. I'd prefer to have the attorney appointed. I would prefer
that. But you just said that the 90 days should start running once the record is delivered to the defendant or counsel is appointed.
Preferably, I'd prefer to have counsel, but if the court, in its view, would say that counsel it would be burdensome to the system, at least give him the record. And in this particular case, our appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed on July 26, 1993. This court denied review September 23, 1993. And according to Exhibit H, submitted by the state in the habeas proceeding, Exhibit H reflects that the record was sent by trial counsel, who is also appellate counsel, on January 31, 1994. Our pro se application for reopening was filed less than 90 days thereafter. So it certainly fits within our scheme.
Are you arguing that after an appeal is finished at the Court of Appeals, that every defendant then should now get a second attorney to look at his record to see if there is a 26B to be filed?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be consistent with this court's decisions and the United States Supreme Court decisions in Griffin, Douglas, Evitz versus Lucy.
But we don't appoint attorneys after every trial is done to take a look at what trial counsel did to see if they did something wrong.
That's true, Your Honor. However, in State versus Cole, the court recognized when that does not happen, when trial counsel is the same as appellate counsel, those issues of ineffectiveness can still be raised in a post-conviction relief petition. The same is not true if we have different counsel.
So I'm clear, you're saying every time an appellant is done with his appeal, he now gets a second state-appointed attorney to look at the appeal.
Your Honor, I'm saying that's consistent with the United States Supreme Court decisions. I am skeptical of whether the court would do that.
Does a federal court do that?
I'm sorry?
Does a federal court do that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would be asking for an expansion, and I understand that that's quite a request, which is why I'm simply asking that he get the record. You cannot prepare a brief. You cannot understand what issues were raised properly, avoiding plain error, without the transcript. So our position would be that there's a real distinction between the PCR statute evidentiary hearing and the evidentiary hearing here. The evidentiary hearing in Appellate Rule 26B is not to expand the record. This court held in State versus Burke that appellate ineffectiveness is not determined by issues off the record, but by what issues were not raised on the record. So if counsel had on appeal the record, the transcript, and failed to raise an obvious question, well, that might be appellate ineffectiveness. So the state's suggestion is not appropriate, and it's inconsistent with the reality of applications for reopening. There are only two bases to satisfy Appellate Rule 26B. Either a record issue was present and not raised, or it was raised on an incomplete record. That doesn't call for an expansion. And to the extent you have an evidentiary hearing, well, frankly, I think under Section 8, that evidentiary hearing is simply designed to ask appellate counsel, why didn't you raise this issue? Because that goes to the heart of a claim of appellate ineffectiveness. Did you fall below the level of competence, and was the client prejudiced? So that evidentiary hearing is a very narrow process, and it's different from the evidentiary hearing we see in PCR. I would also suggest to the court that this court's decision in Murnaghan is significantly different from the way in which we look at the PCR statute. The PCR statute recognizes that counsel has, the United States Supreme Court in holding in Pennsylvania versus Finley, that you're not entitled to counsel, recognizes at page 615 of its opinion that at the time post-conviction relief is sought in most cases, the defendant has had counsel, he's had a court of appeals opinion, and he's had access to the record. So we would say in those settings, PCR is focused solely on creating a new record, whereas appellate ineffectiveness claims are focused on identifying whether, given the record, did appellate counsel fail in his or her obligations. I realize my time is running out, Your Honor. Unless the court has any further questions, I would conclude.
Do we have to declare this to be a direct appeal to say that the appellant can have the record?
Yes, Your Honor, because Congress chose those words post-conviction precisely, and we would presume they reflect the United States Supreme Court decisions on which the Supreme Court has held there is no right to counsel. I could still prevail in the federal district court if the court were to find that I had to have the record before the application was to be filed, because that would establish cause, a reason for filing timely, and also prejudice, that he couldn't develop the record in a timely fashion. For those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask the court to answer both questions in the affirmative, that in fact we are entitled to have counsel and or the record, and that the application for reopening became part of the direct appeal at the point in time when my client filed pro se his application for reopening. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. Cole, you've saved almost 5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. As Justice Stratton succinctly put it, the real key here is right to counsel for every appellate rule 26B petition that gets filed and whether or not there's going to be a right to counsel.
Now, I think I understood it a little differently than that. Not that every 26B applicant has a right to counsel, but that every defendant who completes his appeal has a right to counsel to see if he has a 26B.
And that's
that
right,
seems
Your Honor.
To be
it's even broader than that. It's not, it would be the right, you could always complain if you wanted to raise your ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim in federal court on habeas, you could always say, I get to do it because they didn't give me a counsel after my first appellate counsel to review whether or not he had been effective. That's absolutely right. And that's it's an example of the cart driving the horse. I mean, the real argument that we have here from Mr. Eads is that, well, I'm entitled to counsel, and the way I get counsel is by making this part of direct appeal, and so it must be part of direct appeal, which is exactly backwards. Of course, we should be saying, is it part of direct or is it part of post-conviction, broadly understood? And once we answer that question, then we know whether or not a right to counsel attaches. But we shouldn't drive the question of, is it direct or post-conviction, based on the desire to give counsel or not give counsel. It's the first inquiry from which the second follows. With respect to that argument, though, I didn't really hear much about why this should be considered direct rather than post-conviction. It was just this notion, well, they really should get a counsel. Well, that might be a reason we could change Rule 26B and provide a counsel as a matter of state law. And in response to Chief Justice Moyer's question, yeah, of course, the state could choose to provide, or this court could provide by way of rule, that they must be given the appellate record. The defendant must be given the appellate record. We could do that as a matter of state law. Now, if we say it's part of direct review and it's part of the initial appeal of right, then as a matter of federal constitutional law, there's going to be a requirement for counsel. But there's nothing stopping.
But if we say it, if we don't call it a direct appeal, we say, but we think you ought to have the record, what happens in the federal court? No habeas yet, right?
Well, no habeas. I mean, there'd be a state right to getting the record, and if that didn't happen, then you'd have to run through the ramifications of whether or not there's actually a procedural default then if you failed to provide something that's required by state law. As, for instance, already the rule provides for appointment of counsel once the petition is granted. So in the reopened appeal stage, we provide as a matter of state law a right to counsel. That isn't a right that exists as a matter of federal constitutional law, as this is part of post-conviction, but as a matter of state law, the state says you get a counsel.
Mr. Carroll said that's a little late because, as he accurately seems to me emphasizes, it's very different. The client at the trial stage, we've seen it all the time, where the client says, well, I had my brother and sister, they could have testified, had all this stuff, lawyer, you didn't even go talk to them. At the appellate level, that's essentially a legal argument. The client's not going to know, or the defendant's not going to know, whether something was missed or not. It is a different situation, isn't that circumstance?
It seems different, and
so
that
what?
Might.
That's a,
well, no, I mean that might caution that, yeah, the state of Ohio to say, as Justice Stratton raised the question, I mean, maybe the state of Ohio could say everybody does get a second appellate counsel to look at how their first appellate counsel did. The state could do that, but that to me isn't a reason to characterize this as post-conviction or characterize it as direct. The question of where it fits within the Ohio appellate process is a matter of Ohio law that seems to me should be separate from and prior to the question of should we give them counsel.
We need to look at your argument seems to be we need to look at the general principles by which we determine whether something is a direct appeal or post-conviction, and that's what should drive our decision.
Right, and that general principle shouldn't be, do we want to provide them counsel or not? Because we're always free to provide counsel. If we choose as a matter of state law, we think it's a good idea to provide counsel. But this notion that, oh, if we want to provide counsel, we should call it direct, and that then means as a matter of federal constitutional law, they're entitled to counsel, just seems backwards from that. And the general principle, I think, that we see under Ohio law is that if you can consider evidence outside the record, and Mr. Caro admitted that, yes, there can be these evidentiary hearings where you bring in new evidence. If you can consider that evidence outside the record, that's the hallmark of post-conviction relief. That's the whole idea. I think there was a question about sort of the, can it be raised on direct appeal? Yes, it can be raised on direct appeal. And sometimes the failure to raise ineffective assistance of appellate counsel on direct appeal to this court means you're barred by res judicata from bringing it up in a 26B. Well, if it's res judicata, that means first case, second case. If you didn't have a first case and a second case, you couldn't have res judicata. It clearly is a second case, which makes it post-conviction review under Ohio law, and that's the way the question should be answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.